This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dr. Jeremy Straub is an assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science and the director of the NDSU Institute for Cybersecurity. His work in cybersecurity relates to how to autonomously detect and protect computer systems from online attacks. Dr. Straub, welcome. What a timely topic to talk about on Main Street.
Well, definitely, and thanks for having me, Craig.
I'm very curious today to talk about the intersection of artificial intelligence and cybersecurity, and that's, I think, where you have focused a lot of your recent work. And I guess to begin our discussion, what are the largest cybersecurity threats that leave you spinning in when you're about ready to go to sleep at night?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, you know, what they call the unknown unknown. You know, so it's the thing that we don't really know about yet. It's the thing that, you know, may be lurking out there that nobody's detected, that nobody's really thought of. And that's always the challenge, right, is trying to stay ahead of, you know, what the various adversaries out there are going to be trying to do next and trying, you know, to project what somebody's going to think of as their next attack to make sure that we're able to defend against it. And, you know, so that's a lot of what I do is kind of thinking about, you know, what could go wrong, what might go wrong, and what would have to happen for that to go wrong. And again, how do we prevent that? How do we actually make, you know, make cyberspace safe for everybody?
And there's so many different definitions of we here. I perhaps could make a mistake on my email and then be subject to malware. My electricity provider might make a mistake and then have his grid subject to attacks. The federal government might make a mistake and have our Social Security numbers, et cetera, exposed. What are the biggest risks? Or is it all of the above?
Well, I think it is all of the above. I mean, I think, you know, every place where a computing system, you know, is being used is somewhere where something could go wrong. And, you know, that's the challenge, right, is that there are so many things that we're all so dependent on working every day that, you know, all it takes is one or two of those to go wrong or to be hacked or, you know, even to have an inadvertent issue. And it can, you know, can really create problems for people because we're, again, we're so dependent upon technology these days. And, you know, it's really kind of amazing when you think about it with all these different systems, how much goes right every day, you know, just so that, you know, again, the power is, you know, flowing into the buildings, the, you know, internet's working, all of these things we kind of take for granted. There's a lot of work and a lot of, you know, technological capability behind each of these things, you know, actually working.
Are there more people working to use artificial intelligence to attack cyber systems, or are there more people working on how to use artificial intelligence to defend computer systems, do you think?
I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure anybody's ever really, you know, done the math.
Are we supposed to know that? Probably.
Probably not. And I mean, certainly there's, you know, when you think worldwide too, there's a lot of, you know, different players that have people working on both sides of it. And, you know, some of the work too really doesn't necessarily have a side. You know, one of the things like when you're looking at how to defend a system, you also need to be thinking about how an attacker could attack that system. And so, you know, if you think about maybe, you know, an entity that discovers a breach, particularly as like a state actor where they might, you know, at some point need to, you know, attack another state's cyber systems, they may be looking to prevent that breach from being used against their own systems while at the same time keeping track of it as something to use against their adversary. So by detecting a vulnerability in a system, you actually potentially have something that's both offensive and defensive in its use.
When you talk about state actors, we hear in the news of the Russian hackers or the Chinese hackers. Don't hear a lot about American hackers, although I'm sure they're there. Which country is most vicious in your eyes when it comes to this stuff? Or are we not knowing the whole stories here?
Well, I think, you know, one of the challenges that we have is that a lot of attacks are not fully attributed. So we don't really know, you know, for a given, you know, thing that happens, was it a state actor? If it was a state actor, who was it? And, you know, there's a variety of reasons for this. Sometimes groups claim, you know, credit for something, and it may be to try to increase their own perception, and it might not be accurate, right? They may be saying they did something when it wasn't actually them. And on the other hand, there are sometimes when a group will do something and not claim credit for it as a way of, you know, trying to prevent retaliation against them by making it, you know, still ambiguous as to who actually did it. So I don't know if you really, you know, would want to necessarily think about it in terms of, you know, viciousness, quote unquote. I think, you know, certainly thinking about who has the greatest capabilities is a really big question. And I'm not sure there's a great answer for that either. I mean, I think there are a lot of state actors out there that are trying to improve their capabilities, and certainly a lot of state actors that want to be in that number one slot. And potentially even in terms of different industries, right? You might have somebody that's, you know, much better at attacking older systems versus newer systems or systems with certain configurations where you may actually have specialties even within the realm of cyber attacks.
There are so many different roads this discussion can go down. What did you think when you first saw ChatGPT?
Well, you know, ChatGPT is a neat system, right? And, you know, I mean, I think particularly now with the newer versions of ChatGPT, where it produces such, you know, human-like text, you know, it's something where you can read it, and most of the time, you know, it seems like somebody that's pretty good at writing has actually produced the text. And I think that's what's got a lot of people kind of aware of it and more concerned about it than they have been in the past, is just it seems so human-like. And, of course, we're really used to reading stuff from other humans. And when, you know, it writes something that seems like it's been written by another human, I think that causes people to have concern. You know, there's an old standard called the Turing test that's been around for a while that is all about that. It's about whether a human perceives, you know, the computer basically as being another human. And I think, you know, again, this is what ChatGPT has done, right? At least in the context of, you know, written language, it's being perceived by humans as, oh, wow, this is something that seems like another human. And so I think in that regard, that's why people have gotten so kind of engaged by this, alarmed by this, and so interested in it.
Are you alarmed or are you engaged?
Well, I think, you know, I think there's a lot of potential to it. And I think it's really important that people understand that ChatGPT, it's a good writer, right? I mean, it can write, you know, emails. It can write, you know, possibly write
books,
screenplays,
scripts,
books.
Yeah, the whole thing.
But it's not going to, you know, it's not going to drive your car. You know, it's been shown to not be super great at playing chess in a few examples. You know, it's a very limited scope in terms of what it can do. So I don't think people need to be concerned about it. I think it's great that it's getting people interested in AI, though, too, because that's been a challenge of getting people kind of, you know, aware of the potential of the, you know, this technology or these technologies, I guess, more correctly. And I think ChatGPT has caused people to say, wait, this is something that, you know, at least within this scope of the written word is ready for prime time. You know, and again, we know there's a lot of accuracy issues with it. I think we've all heard stories about, you know, it's hallucinating articles in one newspaper and, you know, it's made some, you know, false allegations and a variety of things. And obviously those are things that need to be improved. Those are real problems. But the fact that, you know, just in terms of, you know, if you think about like writing a screenplay or writing a sitcom episode where, you know, it can do that, right? It can get into character. It can speak in character. You know, that's a pretty, pretty interesting accomplishment. And, you know, again, obviously, you know, we need a human to go through and to make sure that, you know, it's accurate still. You know, if you're making a, you know, a sitcom, you need to make sure that it's funny. You know, the computer may not get what humans find funny, or might make things that are, you know, funny in a way that the director or whatnot of the series is not interested in being. You know, it might be people laughing at the technology as opposed to, you know, laughing with the technology, depending on what it produces. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I think it gets so close that, you know, if you think about the processes that, you know, we use to actually create content, you know, a room of writers each, you know, kind of bouncing ideas off of each other and building on that, you know, if ChatGPT can do the job of, you know, say four of those writers and we only need one or two more to go back and do some editing, that's still a pretty big, you know, pretty big time savings over, you know, having six writers or 10 writers or something like that. So I think in that regard, it kind of shows us what the power of the technology is.
We're enjoying our conversation with Jeremy Straub, an assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science and the director of the NDSU Institute for Cybersecurity. So let's talk about 60 Minutes last week, and I'll set the stage for our listeners who maybe didn't see the episode. Essentially, an assistant producer was being filmed. She didn't know it. And she got a phone call from her boss that said, in her boss's voice, "Hey, I need my passport number. Can you grab that for me? My trip plans have changed or whatever. Do you have that?" "Oh, sure. Yep, here it is." And then the conversation went on and okay, boom. And within a minute or even less, a hacker had that person's passport number. So what happened is somebody used voice that was available and then was able to create a tool to use a conversation just like you and I are having. And the assistant producer thought it was her boss and was stunned when she learned that it wasn't. I'm worried about that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we need to be more cautious. And I think, you know, what you're seeing there is, you know, a technology being used to, you know, to kind of take advantage of a human that wasn't, you know, wasn't expecting that to be the case.
But isn't that the best place for these computer threats to have success, for somebody who's not suspecting anything? And my son calls me, and they had other examples of people, you know, the son called and in distress, need money for bail or whatever. We've heard that sham before, but maybe for other things. And my guard's down. It sure sounds like my son, who I've talked to a million times in my life. Oh, my gosh.
Well, I think that's the challenge. And I mean, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, when you think about, you know, how through science fiction for so long, we've been kind of preparing ourselves for these types of scenarios. You know, we've had clones, we've had replicators, we've had all these different things of, you know, basically different, you know, species or aliens or whatnot that are, you know, pretending to be something else. And so we've kind of seen how, you know, you might deal with this type of circumstance, you know. And so what could you do to verify, you know, that it was your son or that it is, you know, the, I guess, the producer in the case of the 60-minute segment? You know, I mean, one thing would be to just ask them a piece of information, to verify a piece of information.
Every time my son calls, okay, do you remember when you were a junior in high school and this happened? Okay. You passed the test. Now we can talk. Is this where we're going?
Well, I don't think, you know, I mean, if you're just calling to have a conversation, you know, the stakes may be somewhat lower, you know, but certainly like a request, you know, like you were saying, you know, for money or for, you know, a passport number, you know, I think that would be where you might, you know, ask for that verification of information. You know, on the other hand, if you've been having a conversation and it seems like that person, that's going to be more difficult for the technology
for now
to replicate for now. And I mean, I did just say a moment ago, of course, that, you know, one of the things ChatGPT is pretty good at is speaking in character. But it's still, you know, when you're having a conversation with somebody, particularly somebody that you know well, you know, there's a lot of things that go into the conversation that would be very difficult to replicate technologically. You know, shared experiences, you know, shared things that, you know, you might both have found humorous or concerning or whatnot at one point. And I think if you were having a conversation of any length with somebody, again, that you were, you know, you were close to, and it was the computer, you probably would realize in a lot of cases that they were missing some of that, you know. And you know, you might get to a point where you said, hey, you know, is everything okay? And, you know, of course, in some cases, that might be where, you know, if it was a hacker, they might just terminate the phone call at mm-hmm. that point because, you know, the gig is up, as they say. But, you know, again, it is a concern. And, you know, certainly even, you know, thinking about the types of questions you might ask to validate that it's the person, you need to make sure that that's not something that can be found on Facebook or somewhere else. Because, you know, a simple question may be something actually very easy for somebody to source if it's out there, you know.
Right. Let's turn a little bit to the academic side about what you do, Dr. Straub. So what kind of student really, really does this well and gets into learning about cybersecurity and being successful at it? In my days as a programmer, there's a creative side of what I did and there was the analytical side of what I did. And I think some folks have stronger strengths in different aspects of programming. What kind of student makes the best student for you in what you're teaching?
Well, I think it really, you know, if we're thinking about what, you know, what society needs to develop these new technologies and, you know, to implement them and to actually use them to, you know, for the betterment of humanity, we really need a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of different skill sets. You know, we need people that are very creative, you know, to think of ways to use the technologies, to build new technologies, you know, to build the interfaces to the technologies. And we also need people that are very analytical to do, you know, kind of the behind the scenes work of making it work, testing that it works, you know, making sure that it works all of the time. So I don't think it's any one type of student. I mean, I think, you know, certainly, you know, you need people that are excited about, you know, whatever technology they're working with. You need people that are excited about learning. But in terms of, you know, specific background, I think there's quite a lot of different backgrounds where people can be very successful in, you know, in computer science and more generally now all of computing. Because, you know, computing touches on so many different aspects of our lives that it's really no longer, you know, it's not just programmers anymore. It's a whole ecosystem, you know, of people that interact with software in so many different ways that all need to know a certain amount about computing and all have kind of important roles to play in this ecosystem, even if they're not the hands-on keyboard programmer.
So is our country and our research institutions in general paying enough attention to this? It seems to me that in Wyoming, where I came from, our state government was behind in the effort and the seriousness that it applied to cybersecurity issues. Do your students sense that? And do you believe that we are giving this the gravitas, so to speak, that it needs?
Well, I think it's very difficult to, you know, kind of place things within a national priority system. I mean, there's a lot of different things that draw our, you know, need to draw our national attention right now. And certainly, you know, as somebody that works in this area, I would like to see more attention placed on computing, on artificial intelligence, on cybersecurity. I think there's a lot of reasons why we need to, you know, need to be able to do that and need to be able to prepare ourselves, you know, in the global, you know, ecosystem of different countries that are preparing, you know, their students to compete in a, you know, what is now a global, you know, competitive environment.
Is this competitive or are we working hand in hand with other governments here?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, mm-hmm. I think, you know, even if you think about, you know, our close allies like, you know, the United Kingdom, other countries in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth, you know, even though at a national level we're really close allies, our firms still compete directly, right? You know, you have a company in the United States that's developing a technology. You might have a company in Great Britain that's developing a similar technology. And, you know, whoever gets there first might, you know, might get more customers. So I think, you know, it's a very healthy competition in a lot of ways where, you know, again, we might have, you know, greater progress because companies, individuals, researchers, et cetera, are all racing to see who can develop the best technologies, the best systems first.
So how do you teach your students this? I mean, you're not asking them to break into the Pentagon, but you want them maybe to have simulation tools that kind of show what that might be like and how to defend against it. How does that work in the classroom?
Well, there's a lot of you know, a lot of different tools that we use. You know, we have tools that help students understand how to defend systems. We have tools that help students understand how people attack systems. And really, you know, the goal in cybersecurity education is to give students kind of a holistic understanding of all of the different aspects of cybersecurity, which also includes things like digital forensics. It includes understanding, you know, what is actually part of a cyber attack. And also, you know, very importantly, how a cyber attack, because it has all these different components, provides a lot of different places where somebody can defend against it. You know, there's a really neat concept out there called the cyber kill chain, which is developed by a company called Lockheed Martin, that actually talks about thinking about this in terms of a series of steps that have to be performed by an attacker. And the idea is that basically if you can block any one of those steps, you block that specific cyber attack. Now, it's not to say they can't go do something else,
sure,
right? There might be
and they'll 10,000. Learn and then try to go around it next time, et cetera.
Yep. But again, you know, it gives you a way to think, okay, what, you know, even if you look at like the links in the chain, right, if one link is used a lot, that gives you an idea of, okay, this is something that's very effective that we could do as a defender, because not only does it block this chain, but it blocks, you know, these other 200 chains. And so we can kind of use that type of thing to evaluate, you know, what types of defensive actions make the most sense based upon how valuable this link in the chain is to a particular attacker.
When I go back to my media examples here, my wife and I enjoy Chicago Med, and we were watching last week, and the doctor is using the brand new OR 2.0 as this device that uses artificial intelligence to help him succeed. If you do this, it's an 85% threshold of success. If you do that, it's only 60%. Go here, go there. So he follows the instructions, does his surgery, patient seems like he's doing well, and then he dies. Well, then they do some research, and OR 2.0 introduced something in the medical record to cover its own rear, so to speak. Of course, it was fiction. But I can maybe understand that happening. Are artificial intelligence devices learning to do things like that in your eyes?
Well, I think, you know, certainly in the medical space and for other applications that have similar gravitas, you know, like a self-driving car, we wouldn't want the system to be able to go back and manipulate stuff like that. And a good system wouldn't provide the AI with that capability, you know, or even ideally, you know, provide other people that might be involved with it with that capability.
But I think the point, artificial intelligence, it learned how to do this. Is this something that we should worry about?
Well, I think it's something we should think about. You know, I mean, certainly the beauty of fiction and science fiction is that it helps us think about the problems that we could have. So hopefully we don't have to actually experience them, you know, in reality because we've already thought about them. But I think it's also really important to understand that, you know, modern AI systems are not, you know, they're not out kind of calculating, you know, for their own gain in the way I think the system in Chicago Med that you're describing it was being portrayed. You know, they're given goals, they're given things that they're supposed to do, they're given mechanisms to do them, and they're not, you know, they're not at the point where they're, you know, kind of self-aware, where they're thinking, oh, this is going to be bad for me if this happens.
And a very simplistic question then is, does humans program these devices? Bottom line, that's what happens. However, they can learn. We've heard the term machine learning. Mm-hmm. So paint us that picture a little more clearly there.
Well, I think, you know, with machine learning, you're talking about basically the system being able to take information from around it and use it to better perform, ideally, you know, the tasks that it's supposed to be doing. And there's a lot of different ways of doing machine learning. Some systems may be learning on the fly, and they may be incorporating what they've learned, you know, kind of immediately into the way that they're interacting with, you know, with humans, with whatever they're doing. In most cases, though, these wouldn't be systems that are being used for something like a surgery or driving an automobile, because we need to test and make sure those systems are, you know, are very reliable, right? There's very high stakes to them. And, you know, certainly in the case of like a medical system, they have to go through a process, again, in most cases of being approved by the FDA, which is going to want to make sure that they work, you know, all of the time. And so machine learning for a system like that could mean collecting data over time and then having kind of a deliberate learning phase where the system takes that data, processes it, you know, uses a form of analysis on it, and then comes up with some candidate, you know, suggestions, changes, et cetera, to implement. And then you would still potentially have a human who's involved in saying, okay, you know, is this still working well? Does it work better with these changes? Is it still safe? To make sure that you wouldn't have, you know, something where, you know, the system might be learning something that doesn't make sense, you know, learning from kind of a weird case that isn't, you know, isn't a typical case, or kind of in your example with Chicago Med, learning, you know, something, you know, kind of nefarious. And I think I should probably also say that that kind of learning, the way that it, you know, sounds like it was put together kind of in that fictional scenario, that's not really how machine learning works. It's machine learning is a lot more basic than that now at this point. You know, that, you know, again, there's kind of a, you know, nefarious, I don't know, you kind of almost, you know.
Yeah, but what it struck me, though, is if you look at it in the context that billions of dollars are now at stake here, could this possibly happen? And yeah, it's a stretch, but in the future, I do wonder about that. I'm curious about how you integrate user behavior and the analytics that are tied to user behavior in how you defend against cyber attacks and how you teach that as well.
Well, certainly there's a lot that relates to, you know, understanding the user. And I mean, understanding the user from a cybersecurity perspective can be helpful to detect somebody that's not supposed to be there. It can be helpful to detect something that's changed. You know, one of the big things that we talk about a lot in cybersecurity is the concept of an insider threat, where somebody within an organization, you know, goes from, you know, being a happy employee,
a good guy to a bad guy.
Exactly. and you know, how do we detect that? How do we, you know, prevent them from doing, you know, doing damage once that change has happened? And so analytics can be helpful for that as well. You know, we also use analytics to try to understand adversaries, you know, both kind of collectively understanding how a particular type of threat actor acts, how particular threat actors, meaning kind of groups, associations, organizations act, and then looking at particular specific attackers, the human or maybe even the electronic system that's attacking at the moment. And all of that, you know, that analytics can be really helpful in terms of kind of figuring out what they're doing, maybe where they're going to go next. So there's a lot to analytics. It's a really important area. And certainly in the context of education, you know, there's a lot of different things that a student can learn about, you know, analytics.
Jeremy Straub is an assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science and the director of the NDSU Institute for Cybersecurity. So much to talk about, Jeremy, but thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Glad to be here.
There's more to come, but first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Legislative Management Committee is now looking at the interim studies that will be done before the 2025 legislative session. The legislature approved 80 studies. Of those, 21 are required studies and 59 are optional. House Majority Leader Mike LaFour of Dickinson chairs Legislative Management. He told the committee the average number of studies over the last several bienniums has been between 45 and 49.
So if we are to get to the range of between 45 and 49, where we have been the last three biennia, we would have to eliminate 31 of the 59 optional.
One of the optional studies okayed by the committee is a study concerning electric vehicles. Fargo Democratic Senator Tim Mathern supported that study. He says the State Department of Transportation had asked for and received $25 million for charging stations.
There are people deciding whether or not to come to North Dakota based on plug-in stations. Whether we do more or not, we certainly need to learn more about this demand coming in our future.
The study will also look at the reductions in motor vehicle fuel taxes as electric vehicles become more common. A standard review of NDUS Chancellor Mark Hagerot generated a little extra discussion at this week's Board of Higher Education meeting. Board member Jeffrey Volk says with the just concluded legislative session, maybe it would be wise to include lawmakers in the review process. Board Chair Casey Ryan says that would be a huge bucket that could be skewed depending upon what lawmakers get picked. Board member Nick Hacker, a former legislator, says a lot of feedback already goes into the process. Hacker says if lawmakers are brought into the mix, it should be a targeted group.
Pick people that, you know, so you're not randomly picking who happened to be the negotiator on the appropriations bill, but that changes every once in a while. And it's a whole bunch of inside baseball. And I don't think that's fair to try to gather feedback from inside baseball players. And I think we should just go ask the leadership or something along those lines.
Chancellor Hagerot says he's always open to additional feedback, but...
You know, there were some bills where legislators were mad at me. Tenure bill, I'll be up front, okay? I had one legislator said, you were working in the back room to kill that bill, weren't you? You know, I mean, so I'm just saying, you know, I work for you.
The board approved the current method of review on a unanimous vote with a report due on June 27th. And North Dakota State University's Early Entry Program offers opportunities for high schoolers to get a head start on their college education. Stacy Duffield is director of the Office of Teaching and Learning at NDSU. She says the program allows high school students to take college classes while still attending high school, many of which can count as dual credit or count toward both their high school and college credits. She says the program is intended for students in grades 10 through 12 and has a GPA requirement for enrollment. Duffield says the program not only offers students additional academic challenges, but also offers ways for them to explore a career path. And she says it makes financial sense, too.
Another really nice benefit is that it's a reduced tuition rate. And so instead of the regular tuition rate, it bills out at about $154 a credit, which is a substantially less than the full price of a credit. And so they can get just a nice head start at a less expensive rate than they would have later.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Memorial Day right around the corner. Schools in North Dakota already out or nearing being done for the year. It is time for summer vacations. We hear now from Sarah Audie Coleman, the director for North Dakota Tourism, in a conversation with Prairie Pulse host John Harris.
Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's talk about spring and summer tourism in North Dakota. What's the outlook?
We're very optimistic. Right now, we're seeing really solid numbers in terms of interest and people coming in. Of course, our advertising campaign is just rolling now. And we think that, you know, the economy's tricky, right? There's inflation's tough. But Americans are prioritizing travel. And they're prioritizing safety and good value. And we think that we're positioned really well for that. So we're excited to get the summer travel season off.
This winter, sort of a long winter for a lot of folks. Do you think that will contribute to more visitors sort of getting outside and wanting to do things and seeing the many sights in North Dakota?
I do think so, especially within the region, because it was a tough winter for a lot of us throughout the region. I also know that the Canadians are super excited to get back, and they're going to eliminate some of the barriers at the border here in the next few weeks. So we're excited to also see some of that pent-up demand from the Canadians who haven't been coming down since the pandemic.
Can you talk a bit about how that impacted tourism and whether or not things have kind of gotten back to normal or not?
Yeah, you know, I think there's always going to be that pre-COVID, post-COVID comparison. We still compare all of our metrics back to 19 and kind of, you know, using the last few years as just regrowth years. But it's impacted a lot of the way people do business, the way people think. You know, I don't think we're ever going to be back completely to normal, but I feel like our offerings, a lot of our offerings, we didn't have to close down for very long. We were able to keep that continuity. Most of the attractions and events are all back up to full speed and are even looking at expansions and adding additional enhancements to attract new visitors. So we're in a good place.
Mm-hmm. Now, this one, talk about your tourism business development focus. It targets needs and gaps in your current offerings, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, when you think about North Dakota, what a lot of people think of are outdoor recreation. They think about agritourism. And those are some of the areas that we probably have the least offerings in. So we're really working hard to try and develop a tourism business development plan where we're not only selling and marketing what we have, but we're also trying to build that supply, build those offerings. And so what we're focusing in some gap areas, we're focusing in some specific areas that have a lot of potential for growth. Just with some additional build-outs. And so we're excited to have this new position. We've got some new tools to be able to incentivize tourism business development as well. And so that will be continue to be a focus here going forward in the next year or two.
Well, when you say areas of growth, what areas are you targeting? What are they?
Well, like I mentioned, there's the niche areas. You think about outdoor recreation, and in a lot of cases, we're kind of a do-it-yourself destination. You know, you bring your camper, you bring all of your toys, all of your equipment, you bring your own horses because we don't have a lot of places where you can do trail rides. So those are the kind of offerings that we're trying to augment and incentivize and try and encourage further growth of. And then there's also those regional areas that just have tremendous potential. You know, the Rendezvous region up in the Pembina Gorge area, the Turtle Mountain region, where they've got four seasons activities, outdoor recreation, scenic byways, you know, a lot of the components to really build out really vibrant tourism economies.
Can you talk a little bit about how you promote things like birding?
Yeah, in fact, we actually just had an email that went out to a specific birding audience focused on birding. That's a great spring activity, and with more wildlife refuges than any other state, it's a great niche for us. It also really helps drive people to those rural areas. Some of our national wildlife refuges have really great infrastructure, and by that I mean boardwalks and overlooks and visitor centers where people can really get a feel for where to see the birds and what kind of species they can see there. And then there's even drives that are more formal on paths that people can take. You know, communities like Steele and Carrington and Lisbon and Garrison have really kind of built, you know, kind of those packages around that birding niche.
Mm-hmm. What about your campaign now? Hello, North Dakota, a new campaign. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so the Be Legendary continues to be our brand, and we just kind of continue to evolve that and kind of create new creative that just encourages people to explore, take that next step to do some research on what they might be able to do and see here in North Dakota. So Hello, North Dakota is kind of, hello, you know, we're super welcoming. People comment about that all the time, that they've never been any place that's friendlier. And so we're building on that kind of hospitality, that friendliness that is so intrinsic in all of our communities and all of our attractions. But it also has kind of another meaning in that, hello, North Dakota. You know, people don't know anything about us. You know, we did some national perception research last year that showed it was only 22% of Americans that really knew much about North Dakota. So it's like, hello, you should learn about what we have to offer here. And we're more than you think, and you're going to be unexpectedly surprised when you come.
And, of course, your Be Legendary, you mentioned, it still resonates well for you and working well?
It does. Yeah, it does. We still have that thread that kind of has run through the campaigns for, you know, over 20 years. Again, really trying to encourage people to actively be legendary. Come to North Dakota and do something unique.
Well, as we know, the legislative session ended just not too long ago. How did your department fare during the session?
You know, we did okay. We were able to get some, to replace some of dollars that we had last biennium for the marketing campaigns. We also were given some dollars to do some grants for business tourism, business development that we'll be rolling out this summer. And then we also have, because we're the kind of experts in marketing the state, we also market the state for not just a visitor, but also workforce and talent and new residents. And so we were entrusted with some additional dollars to build off the Find a Good Life in North Dakota campaign. 76% of our new residents visited first and then moved. And so we know there's a lot of synergy between those two campaigns and those two work areas, and so we're excited to continue that work.
Finding workers for businesses is hard, but what about staffing like at state parks and forts and things like that? Is that a challenge for your department and for those organizations?
It's a big challenge, especially the seasonal positions. You know, more and more you're hiring some seasonals and they maybe aren't staying the whole season. So then you have to regroup, you know, halfway through the summer. So Historical Society and state parks and even national parks really struggle to fill those positions. So we're hopeful that all of them will get filled. They're fun jobs. Hopefully people will see the opportunity in them and that we'll be able to fully staff all of the operations coming into the summer.
But technically those employees are not your employees.
Correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. They work for other divisions mm-hmm. within state government or federal government.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the top tourist destinations in the state, and which ones do you think will be top this summer?
You know, the top attraction is normally always the national park, mm-hmm. Although with the weather this past winter, they're tracking a little below where they were last year. State parks are also really popular, sites like the Heritage Center and our venues, which have, you know, big events that attract people from all over are our major attractions. What I'm really excited about are some of the new offerings that are coming online this summer. So just last weekend, the Discovery Center, Magic City Discovery Center, a new children's museum in Minot opened. The Gateway to Science Center, which is in a beautiful building overlooking the Missouri River in Bismarck, has seen great numbers already here in the first few months of operation. If you look just down the hill from there, you'll see the Heritage Landing, which is where the Lewis and Clark Riverboat leaves, and it also has a beautiful deck and restaurant and coffee shop located there, so that's brand new. Of course, the Brouhaha here at Drecker in Fargo, I think the hotel is pretty close to being opened. It wasn't open a few weeks ago when I was there, but that's an exciting new addition. And then the conservatory, which is up at the International Peace Gardens, that will also be opening, that new big expansion up there. So I think we're excited about the new attractions. I think they're going to do really well this summer.
Can you quantify out-of-state visitors versus in-state visitors?
Yeah, you know, technology has really helped with that. When you look at all the data sources that we have now, you know, most cars, I think 90% of new cars all have GPS in them. We all carry around our cell phones or our tablets, our gaming units. So there's a lot of data out there that we can use to try and determine who our visitor is, where they're coming from. What we're seeing is that about half of our visitation is North Dakotans choosing to travel and spend their dollars here in North Dakota, which is super good, right? And then the other half is non-residents. So that's about 11 million non-resident visitors. And they're primarily coming from our target markets where we are marketing within the region. So you're looking at, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, South Dakota, Illinois. We also did some new marketing campaigns in Colorado and Texas this past year, so those numbers are starting to show. And then, of course, the Canadian provinces of Manitoba and Saskatchewan.
I know I ask you this probably every year, but what are some of your favorite hidden gems in the state?
Well, my new favorite is Cows and Company in Carrington. So a beautiful, beautiful farm in Carrington, a large dairy operation who has taken the farm to table to really the perfect level. They not only make gelato that they used to just deliver, but they now make Gouda cheese, which they learned to make, you know, back in the old country. And have a beautiful facility on this farm in Carrington. So that's just a new favorite. We actually went out and did a photo shoot after I was there a couple years ago. We did a photo shoot there this past year. So they're in some of our advertisements. And then another area, I think the west part of Lake Sakakawea. A lot of people don't get all the way west to like McKenzie Bay and that area. It's just beautiful with the islands and the topography that you have out there. It's really, really fun and beautiful.
Hmm. Can you walk us across the state with some of the various forts that people can visit and what they'd see if they go there?
Yeah, our website has a great itinerary for forts if you're into that history, but let's start in the east. So Fort Ransom, Fort Abercrombie are all out here in the eastern part of North Dakota. Then Fort Totten in the Devil's Lake area. And then as you get to the central area, you've got Fort Stevenson, which is on Lake Sakakawea. Fort Mandan, of course, Lewis and Clark fame on the Missouri River, and Fort Abraham Lincoln. And then as you go out west, you've got Fort Buford and then Fort Union, of course, which is a federal site. So great history at all of those. Good activities too. Kids, you know, can run up in some of those blockhouses and explore. So those are really fun things to do in the summer.
Are all of them staffed so that you can get answers and have tours of any or get information?
Yes, all of those sites are staffed. Some of them are state historic sites, some of them are state parks, some of them are federal entities, but they all do have operational hours and visitor centers. And while they might not have a narrated tour, you get pointed in the right direction and you can do a self-guided tour.
Yeah. Okay, what about some of the events? What are some maybe big events you have going on throughout the summer?
So we have, right now we have over 200 events on our website, which that this time of year is growing every day because there's a portal where you can, where people can enter their own event onto the website. So it's always hard to hone in, but you've got, of course, you've got all the great festivals that happen, the small town festivals. I think Walhalla is celebrating 175 years mm-hmm. this year. So that will be a lot of fun. Some of the big events, for example, Mandan Rodeo Days, which I think it's their 144th year this year. They're one of the oldest, longest running rodeos in the country. They have a brand new arena. So that will be a really unique and fun to go out there and see how they've enhanced that. And then you look at the fairs, you know, Red River Valley Fair and the State Fair and all of those are mean summer, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You mentioned Sakakawea, but can you talk a little bit about more of the recreation and water attractions in the state?
Yeah, so Lake Sakakawea has some great offerings, both on the North Shore and the South Shore, you know, east to west. Obviously, it covers a lot of geography. So there's number of ways that you can get on the water too, more than we've ever had before, where you can rent, you know, paddle boards and kayaks, or you can go out on the cruise out of out at the Mandan Hidatsa Rikura Visitor Center is kind of connected to the yacht that they have there up near Newtown. Lots of great recreation there. Devil's Lake, of course, has expanded. They've got great resorts on that lake and more places than ever, again, where you can rent boats and watercraft and paddle boards and whatnot to get on the water in Devil's Lake as well. And then Lake Metegoshi is, of course, the other one that's just, you know, beautiful northern lake, more wooded than the others. There as well, there's great amenities on the lake and plenty of things to do to get you out there on the water. And then the Missouri River. You know, I think people sometimes forget about the Missouri River in Bismarck, but there's you know, number of restaurants and places you can rent, again, ways that you can get out and enjoy. Or if you don't want to be on the water and you just want to, you know, rent a bike or bring your bikes with, then you can, you know, bike along the trails and go to different restaurants and places along the river in Bismarck and Mandan as well.
Well, there's a lot to do, it sounds like. But in your travels, maybe to conferences or with your colleagues across the United States, what have you learned about tourism in other parts of the country and how they're doing?
You know, I think everybody's doing pretty well. Our region was probably the first region to really recover from the pandemic, and now you're kind of seeing that wave go out to the other more metro areas, especially along the coasts. So I think everybody's pretty optimistic. Of course, the concerns are our economy, and I think places that are more dependent on air travel, people are concerned. I mean, traveling, air travel is a hassle right now. There's some barriers there. And so I think that's going to fare well for those of us that really focus. And not that we don't have a lot of people fly to North Dakota too, but the bulk of our visitation is drive traffic. And so I think it is going to favor the drive destinations a little bit again this year.
Sure. What's the best part of your job?
Well, the best part is probably getting to go do things and see things, which I don't get to do as often as I'd like to. I think a lot of people think that I get to do that every week, but I don't. Heading up to the Peace Gardens this afternoon for a conference up there tomorrow. And so I really just love to get out and see the areas and see how passionate people are about sharing their stories and sharing their state and business with our visitors.
Yeah. Well, we are about out of time. So if people want more information, where's the best place for them to go?
They should go to ndtourism.com. Tons of information, itineraries. You can search any way you want.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
That was North Dakota Tourism Director Sarah Audie Coleman in conversation with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. You can check out all episodes of Prairie Pulse on our YouTube channel. An essay from Jesse Veder is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Continuing the family line that includes Father Tom and late Uncle Harry, the harmonizing folk duo the Chapin Sisters are back with their first album in 5 years, and we've got them live on the next Great American Folk Show.
Will the street
I'm Tom Brusseau. You'll also enjoy the country-tinged folk of Jess Williamson.
The difference between us is when I sing it, I really mean it.
Plus music from Sean Marshall and Annie Sandral of Three Sisters Flower Farm will be on the show. And Fargo chef Summer Peterson shares a creamy tomato soup recipe good for any season. The Great American Folk Show, Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Does this sound familiar, being a kid and just waiting to be old enough to set your own rules? And then maybe you get older and you wish you were a kid again and had that much freedom and that much joy. Aging is a mindset. We get a reminder today from Jesse Veder with this essay, When I Grow Up.
Today I want to share a piece that closes out my book, Coming Home. I wrote it when I was still in my 20s, in our first year back here at the ranch. I was seeing this place through new eyes, realizing what time can do to us, clinging tight to the things that made me as I was discovering them again. Those gray hairs I talk about are pushing through strong, and I realize in the rereading, I didn't define what grown-up actually means. Is it now? Is it ever? When I grow up, I want to be the kind of woman who lets her hair grow long and wild and silver. When I'm grown, I hope I remember to keep my flannel shirts draped over chairs, hanging in the entryway and sitting on the seat of the pickup where they are ready and waiting for me to pull them on and take off somewhere, the scent of horsehair on the well-worn sleeve. When I grow up, I want to remember every spring with the smell of the first buds blooming on the wild plum trees, what this season means to me. When I grow up, I pray I don't forget to follow that smell down into the draws where the air falls cooler the closer you get to the creek and the wind is calm. When I grow up, I hope I don't find I have become offended by a bit of mud tracked from boots onto the kitchen floor. I hope I keep the windows open on the best summer evenings with no regard for the air conditioning or the dust, because a woman can only be so concerned with messes that can be cleaned another day, especially when she needs to get the crocuses and some water. When I'm older and my memory is full, I hope that the smell of damp hay will still remind me of feeding cows with my dad on the first warm day of spring when the sun warmed the snow enough to make small rivers to run on our once frozen trail. I hope it reminds me how alive I felt wading in that stream while he rolled out the bale and I tested the limits of rubber on my boots. When my hair turns silver, I hope I remember that my favorite colors are the colors of the season changing from brown to white to green to gold and back again. I pray I never curse the rain and that I don't forget that next to the rosy flush in my baby's cheeks, rain is my favorite color of them all. Yes, when I'm old and my knees don't bend the way they need to bend to get me on the back of a horse, I hope I'm still able to bury my face in her mane, to run my hands across her back and lean on her body while I remember the way my spirits lifted as she carried me to the hilltops. I hope I recall how the first ride of spring made my legs stiff, my back creak, and my backside sore, even as a young woman with muscles and tall boots. Yes, boots. When I'm old, I hope I will wear my red wedding boots every once in a while, and remember how I stood alone in them out in the cow pasture as a young woman, waiting for the horses and wagon to come up over the hill and take me to the oak tree, where my friends and family gathered and the man I loved was waiting to marry me. My red boots will remind me, so in all the shuffle and lost things that become our lives, I hope I remember to save them. And as I watch lines form on my husband's face, little wrinkles around his eyes from work and worry, I hope I remember to say something funny, to tease him a bit, so I might be reminded again how we got the most important ones, the ones that run the deepest. Yes, when I'm old and my hair is silver and long and wild, I hope those things that made me, The dirt turned to mud, a good man's laughter, the soft breath of my child asleep on my chest, the strong back of a horse, the rain that falls on the North Buttes, and the scent of summer rolled up in a hay bale at the end of a long winter. I hope they will be there to see me out, happy and softened and weathered, just like the flannel I'll remember to leave draped over the chair.
Jesse Veeder is a writer, musician, and rancher. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 25th. Memorial Day is fast approaching. Here's a sampling of how communities throughout North Dakota have observed the Day of Military Remembrance, from picnics to parades to poppy sales. In Reeder, North Dakota, the Carl Hendrickson American Legion Post 51 prepared the cemetery for Memorial Day and flew flags on each side of the cemetery avenue. The Legion and the local American Legion Auxiliary began handling Memorial Day programs together in 1922. Proceeds from poppy sales on the Saturday before Memorial Day benefited veterans with disabilities. In 1948, organizers ordered flags to place on every veteran's grave. The Memorial Day parade in 1919 in Pembina was led by an automobile carrying the last two local Civil War veterans. Following them was the first appearance of local World War I veterans parading in formation, wearing helmets. Sailors, the Boy Scouts, campfire girls, and school children were also in the parade lineup. Parade goers held a ceremony on the Pembina River Bridge and decorated the graves of veterans. In 1974, in Ambrose, North Dakota, Sunday school children of the Presbyterian Church marched from the town flagpole to the cemetery to decorate graves. Each child carried a bouquet of wildflowers he or she had gathered the day before. They returned to the church for Memorial Day services. In 1909, Langdon area residents lost five neighbors in a tornado the evening before Memorial Day, giving double significance to the day years afterward. On Memorial Day in 1927, a band marched to the home of the last surviving Civil War veteran in Drake to serenade him. The first Memorial Day service held in New Salem was in 1894, when children gathered in the morning at the Opera Hall and marched to the cemetery with flags and flowers. In the evening, the children gave a recital at the Opera Hall. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the Pioneer Trails Regional Museum in Bowman. We learn about its work and its collections. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.